Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's the Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, it's 1971 in New York City. 10 friends are around a table in Chinatown. Now, this was our first arranged Chinese banquet. We were prepared. We'd read that a true banquet had a formal progression and that the soup was often served in the middle of the meal. Well, the middle of the meal came and there was a long pause. I was praying that the chef had read the same books as we had. Well, he had. A huge carved melon arrived, filled with winter melon soup. Now, we didn't know it then, but we were proof of what our guest Andrew Cole calls the greatest change in America's attitude toward Chinese food. Well, join us for that and much more this hour on The Splendid Table.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
This is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. It's the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Our program is brought to you by Lundberg Family Farms, producer of organic rice and rice products. We got an email from a listener recently asking about miso, the fermented soybean paste from Japan. Now, the writer admitted to being both repelled and attracted at the same time. Miso can smell a little funky. Well, miso is an important tradition in Japan. It's made with fermented soybeans, and it's a pretty painstaking and elaborate process. Now, I don't use it as much as I'd like to, so to give our listeners some ideas, I've asked Sally Schneider to come by. Now, she's a cookbook author, and she's the creator of the Improvised Life website. Hey, Sally, it's good to have you back.
Thanks, Lynn. It's great to be here.
So what do you do with miso?
First of all, I just want to say, give a little range of miso. In Japan, there are over 1,000 of them, and here there are quite a few. There's very mild white misos that are sweet and mildly salty because they have a lot. They actually have grains like rice and barley in them. And then it goes all the way through red, which are very robust because they have more soybeans and they're saltier, on to one that's very chocolatey and wild called a hacho miso. So here's how to think about them. The darker the miso, the stronger and saltier the flavor. And those misos, the dark ones, red misos, often called aka misos, go well with robust preparations like red meats, poultry, and wild mushrooms. The milder ones, and again, there's a sort of a sliding scale all the way down to shiro miso, which is made with largely with barley, go wonderfully with fish and vegetables and milder flavored foods. So there's your range. And the way to get familiar with them is to buy some, mix a tablespoon, or actually a teaspoon, you'd need much less, in a cup of hot water, which will let the flavors bloom, and you can taste them kind of like a wine and get a sense of the range.
And that's essentially one form of a miso broth, right? I mean, right there, you've got something.
Yes, that is a sort of bottom line miso broth. If you add miso in a proportion of 2 to 3 tablespoons per quart of any other broth, you will add a wonderful savor and saltiness. And that's more in the Japanese tradition. I've found that by blending white and red misos and simmering them with things like dried mushrooms and sautéed shallots and even adding some Madeira, miso finds its way into a Western palette of flavors. And I use that broth almost like a veal stock, having used no meat at all to make it. And it's great for improvising soups. You can add potatoes or vegetables or shredded meat or whatever for a delicious instant soup, even raviolis, Lynn.
Wow.
Interesting. So you're saying that you don't have to cook Japanese to use miso.
That's exactly the point. And you can start often with Japanese recipes, like the classic recipe is a glaze and marinade for fish made with white miso and sake and so on. Mm-hmm. And you marinate the fish for about a day and then wipe off the paste. And when you grill it, you have this classic Japanese grilled fish that is caramelized on the outside and utterly succulent. Well, I found if you substitute some of the white miso for red miso and use it on a steak or chicken, you have what is, in effect, an incredible barbecue marinade to put on the grill, and your steaks will have this incredible succulence and almost taste like they're more aged, which is
that's
terrific.
Well, you know, it just occurred to me, umami, I mean, that idea of the fifth taste, the special protein that makes everything else taste better, right?
Right.
I would imagine since it's in soy sauce that miso must be packed with umami.
I think it's exactly that. And that's why I say taste them and also sort of open your senses as you begin to use them. You'll find that that flavor can be an underpinning in all kinds of cooking. Sort of like, I hate to make the analogy, but Parmigiano, you know, has a savor and a saltiness.
Yeah, the cheese
miso does too. It provides that if you use it in a very subtle way.
So what are some other ways to use it? Like, for instance, what does it really marry well with?
Well, one of my favorites is simply half white miso and half almond butter mixed together with a tiny bit of grated orange peel for a spread for bread, which is kind of radical notion.
Yeah, but it sounds like another take on peanut butter.
Yeah, it is, but you get this salty element, salty and savory, just as you're talking about. And there's sort of that effect of a salted caramel, you know, where you have sweet and salty together. I've also used a little, I prefer the white miso, actually. I find I use that the most in a Western-style cooking. I've even used it in salad dressings. It tends to like nuts and hazelnut oil and walnut oil and that sort of thing.
Some great ideas. Sally, thank you.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Sally Schneider is creator of the Improvised Life website. Now, just one thing about miso. If you keep it chilled, you can keep it for a year. Now, see what it can do by trying Sally's two-for-one recipe, her grilled miso-glazed fish fillets with a steak variation. Find the recipe on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, why not check out the other recipes? There's a whole selection on Cheap Eats, recipes that are going to have you eating low to the ground, as they say. And you can also find an archive of podcasts so that you can relive our favorite moments again and again. That's splendidtable.org. Sleeves Up Cuisine. It's a title coined by Jane and Michael Stern for the kind of food they look for all over the country. Now, these two have no use for places with white tablecloths, sommeliers, and maitre d's. But you show them a counter stool and a bowl of good chicken and dumplings, and they're going to rave. Well, the Sterns report their findings on their website, roadfood.com, and here. Jane, Michael, hey, what's the latest? Where have you guys been?
Lynn. We have been to Charleston, South Carolina, and as you well know, Charleston is one of the great eating cities in this country. I mean, not just classic Southern food, but just a great diversity of food that it's got a character all its own. In some ways, it reminds me of New Orleans, maybe without quite as much spice, but with a kind of refinement that is uniquely Charlestonian.
Yeah, you know, you're right, because I think of Charleston and I just think of nonstop eating.
Yeah.
But where are you thinking of specifically at this point?
Well, one of the things that we did last time we were in Charleston was to avoid sort of the best-known restaurants, you know, the really classic low-country dining rooms, which are spectacular, and looked instead for some of the lesser-known soul food restaurants of Charleston. These are a little bit off the beaten track. Some of them are in North Charleston on the outskirts of the city, but there was an entire culture of great Charleston soul food that most tourists don't get a chance to taste.
Our favorite is called Bertha's Kitchen, which is on Meeting Street Road. It's classic soul food, but with a low country twist. For instance, they have turkey purloin, which is like pilau.
Right.
Am I pronouncing any of this even vaguely correctly?
I don't know.
But I don't
we will
either.
Get mail and you'll find out.
Thank you. Hoppin' John and beautiful fried pork chops, pigtails, which sound like you might have to be from that area to appreciate them, but they are absolutely delicious.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And stewed gizzards.
And what's great about this place is that it's cafeteria style, but it's small enough so that the line isn't really a line. I mean, basically, everyone just kind of comes up to the counter and you make eye contact with a member of the kitchen staff, and then you discuss with that member of the kitchen staff exactly what you're going to have on your tray for lunch. Every single meal is slightly different. You say you want a lima bean supper. Well, you want a few extra pigtails in it. No, no pigtails. I think I'll have a few neck bones. I want white rice. No, I want red rice. No, I think I'll have Hoppin' John. I mean, every single meal is constructed. It's like bespoke. You know, it's like you have
your
personal chef.
Yeah, everybody,
and they
it's
go
custom
and kind
made
of create it. It's spectacular. One of the great dishes there is something that you find in a lot of restaurants throughout the South, and that's plain old macaroni and cheese, which here is nothing plain about it. Fortunately, we were the first people in the room at 11 o'clock when the place opened, and so we got our choice of where we wanted the macaroni and cheese from in the big casserole dish.
Mm-hmm.
And I like all the crunchy, chewy, edgy parts. So that's what I got most of, with just enough of the soft stuff in the middle to balance it.
Do they do really good red rice? Because red rice, it's that long grain rice that's, if I recall, the specialty of the Carolinas. And
yes,
cooked with
do.
Bacon and tomatoes. Am I remembering
yep.
that
their
right?
Their red rice is fabulous, as is their Hoppin' John, which is another rice-based dish. But that's what Carolina cuisine really is tremendous amounts of rice-based dishes.
And, you know, the funny thing is we were trying to try as many dishes as possible. One of the ones we got was just white rice. And even the white rice wasn't just white rice. It had little bits of onion, and I think it had been cooked with a chicken stock or something. So even the plainest white rice just, like, burst with flavor.
You know, I'm just thinking, this is probably one of the most beautiful cities we have in the country. Where else do you guys like to go?
Well, a little bit outside of the city is Middleton Place Plantation. This is like a whole day's activity. And in fact, I think you have to pay like maybe $25 to get in. But once you're in, it's a day's worth of fun. I mean, they have blacksmiths working there. They have carriage rides. You can go on a horseback ride. And they have a lunchroom there where you can get like really classic Old South dishes. The menu, as I think you know, Lynn, was created by that great chef, Edna Lewis. And she put things on the menu that you see virtually nowhere else. The one I remember most is Huguenot Tort, which is kind of like sort of like apple pan dowdy. It's sort of an apple crisp, warm dessert with lots of streusel-like things. That I can't describe it exactly, but I can say, it was really good.
You know what I remember? This is so weird that I don't remember the food as well. It's just the gigantic trees with all the Spanish moss hanging from them. And just classic South Carolina landscape.
Yeah, pretty special place. Hey, guys, thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye-bye, Lynn.
In South Carolina, there are many tall pines. I remember the oak tree that we used to climb. But now when I'm lonesome, I always pretend Hickory Green.
Michael Stern's latest tome is an update of their classic Road Food. Now, you can hear the Sterns here every week, but you can get their restaurant finds anytime. You just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to register for this month's book giveaway. This time, it's a copy of the newest vegetarian tome out of England, Plenty, by Yotamo Tulengi. Register for your chance at splendidtable.org. Coming up, chop suey, or how America learned to love Chinese food in spite of herself. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. Hi, this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Maybe second only to pizza, we eat Chinese food. There are around 40,000 Chinese restaurants in the United States. But with Andrew Koh telling the story of Chinese food in America, you have to go back to 1789, when the United States was in its infancy and had sent its first ship to establish trade with China. In August of 1784, the Empress of China sailed up the Pearl River to Canton. That is where our takeout sweet sour pork really began. This is a case of food bringing together two of the most unlike cultures on the planet. Andrew Koh tells the story in his book, Chop Suey, A Cultural History of Chinese Food in America. Andrew, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me, Lynn.
Andrew, I'm thinking about when the first Chinese immigrants came to the United States on the West Coast in the early 1800s, right?
In 1849.
All right, mid-1800s. And opened restaurants. I cannot think of two more unlike cultures. How did Americans react to Chinese food back then?
Americans had a kind of, they were both attracted and repulsed by Chinese food. They were attracted by Chinese food because it was the most exotic food in the world to them. This was an incredibly old and huge culture, which where people ate things like birds' nests and shark's fins, and they ate with sticks, and they had all these kind of strange table customs. But they were also repulsed by Chinese food because the Chinese did things like eat dogs and cats. And of course, that in Western culture, one does not eat one's pets.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was there was this like they were fascinated by it, but they didn't want to get too close.
Well, you say something in the book. You say that one of the greatest shifts in American culinary history happened in 1894. So this is only 50 years later. What happened?
It happened in the mid-1880s. And what happened was in New York's Chinatown on Mott Street, a group of sort of bon vivants and culinary adventurers called the Bohemians discovered a dish they called chow chop suey. And this was a kind of earthy, funky stew made of all kinds of weird ingredients from South China. And they fell in love with it. It was cheap and tasty and filling, and they couldn't stop eating it. They became addicted to chop suey. And this was like the sort of it burst the dam of the kind of prejudice against Chinese food. And suddenly, in New York's Chinatown, everybody wanted to eat chop suey. And the sort of chop suey craze spread from New York all across the country. Yeah. By 1910, everybody was eating chop suey.
Who exactly were these Bohemians?
The Bohemians were a group of artists and writers who were sort of, they were like the artistic rebels of the late 19th century. And they turned their back on the sort of upper crust and the people who ate at Delmonico's. And they were interested in going down to the immigrant districts of Lower Manhattan for kind of exotic adventures. And these included culinary adventures.
So now let's move forward. This was one shift where America started eating chop suey. When was the next important moment in terms of our attitudes toward Chinese food?
Well, after chop suey was discovered, let me give you a little preamble.
Okay.
Something called Chinese-American food developed. And this was Chinese food adapted to American tastes. because the Chinese restaurant owners discovered that the Americans, although they liked chop suey, they didn't like it too exotic and funky. They wanted like an Americanized, and they wanted all the ingredients like easily identifiable. So this thing called Chinese American food developed, which was, you know, chop suey, chow mein, egg foo young, egg rolls, all the classics that we all know and maybe like or maybe don't. And by the mid 20th century, and particularly by the 1960s and 1970s, people were getting tired of that menu. People wanted, there's all these things, pizza was showing up and fast food hamburgers, McDonald's and Burger King. And the Chinese food was kind of seen as old and tired. But then in 1972, a very unlikely savior came to the rescue, and that was President Richard Nixon. Of all people, was the one who opened up relations with China. And everybody suddenly wanted like the food that Nixon was eating in China. They wanted Peking duck. And a revolution started.
There was something else, wasn't there, that also was happening around that time, because there was an immigration act that opened up more Chinese immigration from all of the regions in mainland China? Am I remembering that correctly?
Yes. In 1965, President Lyndon Johnson signed the Immigration and Nationality Act, which got rid of all the old restrictions on Chinese immigration. Now, of course, we didn't have relations with communist China at the time. Mm-hmm. But this opened the door for lots of Chinese from Taiwan and Hong Kong and Southeast Asia, including many chefs. And they began to open restaurants in places like New York and San Francisco, particularly restaurants serving Sichuan and Hunan food. Because they were from Sichuan and Hunan, they'd escaped to Taiwan after the revolution, and then they moved to New York. And when Nixon opened relations with China, people wanted real Chinese food, and they turned to these Sichuan and Hunan restaurants and discovered dishes like General Tso's chicken and Kung Pao shrimp. And suddenly, you know, no one wanted chop suey anymore. They wanted all this new, spicy, strong-flavored, exciting new Chinese, real Chinese food.
So what do you think is going to be the next main taste influence that we're going to see from China?
Well, I hope it's not just one main influence. I hope it's a diversity of influences, because we have in places like Los Angeles and San Francisco and New York, in these Chinatowns, you have people from many, many provinces of China which we've never seen restaurants from before. So in New York now, you can get food from Xi'an, from Qingdao, from...
Where are these places in China?
Well, they're mostly northern and western China. Uh-huh. And the restaurants are great. There are these little tiny hole in the walls, but they have incredible food. And I hope that we have like many more restaurants like this opening up.
So maybe the key is, if you don't recognize where the food is coming from, this is the place to try.
Yes, exactly. If you don't recognize anything on the menu, that's the place.
Andrew, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Andrew Koh's book is Chop Suey, A Cultural History of Chinese Food in America. Now, go to the website for my recipe for Hoisin Chinese noodles with four flavors. And while you're there, take a look at the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. The next time you order a cocktail like an Old Fashioned or a Manhattan, take note. Your drink may be missing a classic ingredient that bartenders are having a harder and harder time getting their hands on. Reporter Lily Jamali explains.
It's Sunday evening at the Clover Club, a bar in Brooklyn that serves up the kinds of cocktails made popular before Prohibition. A bartender prepares a Holland gin cocktail, a drink that takes two dashes of Angostura bitters, an essential ingredient that's increasingly hard to find. There are many types of bitters, but most bartenders consider Angostura the standard. Many classic cocktails were calibrated to Angostura bitters. Only the House of Angostura, a company in Trinidad, holds the secret recipe.
Water, alcohol, sugar, caramel color, Genetian natural flavorings, and added colors. So they really don't tell you, you know, really what, you know, what the story is on what they're actually putting in there.
Julie Reiner owns the Clover Club. Like many bar owners, she's gotten creative to deal with the shortage. After cleaning out the local grocery store, she scaled back on Angostura bitters on her bar's winter menu. And Reiner bought extra bottles from her supplier, who marked them up.
It's a nice guide for selling us the bitters for twice as much. But that's okay. We'll take it, you know. Somebody's got to make some money off of it, right? Capitalism at its best.
A few weeks ago, a woman preparing for a house party was caught red-handed stealing bitters right off Reiner's bar. To deal with the run on Angostura bitters, bartenders around New York have resorted to good old-fashioned hoarding. Ari Form co-owns the Jake Walk Bar a few blocks from the Clover Club. Downstairs in his wine room, he stashed several bottles of Angostura bitters he found on the internet.
There it is. I think we have a case, so there's 12 bottles. Don't tell anybody where they are.
Form says he was blindsided by the shortage.
You never think of something like that running out, especially since they are so popular. Angostura was always there, and everybody had it.
Places like the Jake Walk and Clover Club need the bitters more than your average bar since they feature cocktails. While they can control what's on their drink menus, classic cocktails like Manhattans and Old Fashions require Angostura bitters. Drinks like that just aren't the same without them, says cocktail expert Dave Wandrich.
It helps the drink come together. It kind of pulls it together because it masks some of the more volatile parts of the flavor.
No mention is made of the shortage on Angostura's website. About a year ago, the company's owner fell as a result of the global financial crisis. It was taken over by Trinidad and Tobago's government. As for why there's still a shortage, some bartenders have heard there's a dispute with the bottle manufacturer. But one person who's worked with the company in the past says the operation has melted down. The company didn't respond to a request for comment. So can classic cocktails survive without Angostura bitters? Manhattan drinker Ryan Orcus agrees to test out his drink without them. The bartender wishes him good luck as he takes a sip.
It doesn't have nearly the finish that it had before. The bitters kind of linger and make the drink more enjoyable. So it certainly is a completely different drink.
Unless things change soon, it's a taste he might have to get used to. For Splendid Table, I'm Lily Jamali in New York.
I know what you're thinking. You're heading out to the store to see if you can stock up, right? Well, look, I will bet you that right now at this moment, somebody's in a lab trying to clone Angostura bitters. But I think it'd be a lot more fun to go to the medieval medical handbooks because that's where bitters began. They were the medicines for digestion and melancholy. Medical types back then mixed up bitter herbs. I think the theory was they tasted so bad they had to be good for you. They added spices and sugar and alcohol, and they got a cure. Well, maybe a cure. And they also got a ripe candidate for con artists. Over the centuries, the unscrupulous sorts added irresistibles like opium to the bitters for the cure-all medicines that they'd hawk to just about anybody for a little money. A few doses and you were guaranteed return customers. Well, luckily, the muckraker movement of the early 1900s led to the FDA, and the FDA put the con artists out of business. And today, bitters are benign.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid.
It's time for us to talk. We're opening the lines to you. You can reach us at 800-537-5252 or email splendidtable.org. Anything goes. Okay, let's see. We have Aaron on the line from Northfield, Minnesota. Aaron, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I love to cook, and I have some really close friends who are about to have a new baby. And I'm wondering if you have any advice on how to cook for some new parents who love to eat good food.
First of all, I was thinking maybe buy them a case of wine, but that may not be the way to go.
I think in addition to the case of wine.
In addition. Okay, so you want to make up meals for them that they can have ready to go.
Exactly.
Okay. The first thing, well, obviously you want stuff that can freeze.
Right.
So what I'm thinking is some hearty soups, you know, and since you want to make sure that they're going to get plenty of nutrients, you know, stuff that's good for them, doing things with grains and beans, like, for instance, you could do a pinto bean and barley soup. You can season it any way you want. Okay. I mean, that soup could come from Morocco, Sweden. Ooh. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
You know, to pick your seasonings. The other thing you may want to think about, too, is some vegetable casserole things.
Okay.
I keep going back to Morocco, but what occurs to me—
This would work perfect. They were just traveling in Morocco just over a year ago. So
oh, my. Look at the way tagines are made. These are the slow-cooked stews, mm-hmm. and you can do that with vegetables and grains, or you could do it with meat and poultry or fish. But okay. that's the kind of thing that freezes.
Okay. Yeah, I've never really frozen cooked grains before. Are there particular grains that— Do better freezing?
Most of them do pretty well. I always cook my grains the way I would cook pasta,
okay.
you know, in plenty of salted water, and I let them simmer and until they're quite tender. This is not the time that you want them al dente. You really want them quite tender because when they freeze, they lose some of their natural moisture in the defrosting process.
Okay.
Now, that's not going to make a difference in a soup, but if you're making something like you're going to have them just tossed with maybe something like, you know, butter and fresh herbs, which, by the way, is a delicious way to eat them. Then you'd want to make sure that they were pretty well done if they were going into the freezer. So any soup, any stew, any braise can be frozen.
Okay.
Okay? But there's one other thing I'd suggest. Everybody these days uses bag salads. Make them a jar of homemade dressing.
Oh, okay.
Good vinegar, oil, salt and pepper. And then stock them with little packets of some blue cheese crumbles, you know, some fresh herbs they can tear into that, you know, that kind of thing so that they can vary that basic dressing. And it can be in a jar and it can either sit in the fridge or it can even wait on the counter for a week or so.
Excellent.
Okay.
And are there any spices or anything that I should avoid for, you know, a new breastfeeding mother?
Well, I think most people will tell you not a lot of garlic and not a lot of onion.
Okay.
And again, you know, culturally, in India, obviously, women don't stop eating spicy food because they're nursing. And there's a whole theory about how children develop taste preferences. But I'd stay away from super strong flavors.
Okay.
You know, this is not the time for heavy, heavy seasoning with chili and that kind of thing.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Although, I don't know, I think a baby getting used to that might be a wonderful thing.
If he's going to hang out with me later in life, he should probably get started now.
You want to train this child early? Hey, Aaron, this is important to consider. Hey, what a nice thing for you to do to your friends.
Well,
or for
you.
Your friends. Well, thank you, and good luck to all of you.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Take care. More of your questions coming up, and remember, you can connect with us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or give us a call. 800-537-5252. But right now, it's time for our trivia question. Why should you always choose the first lettuce in the cooler case and not the one from the back of the cooler? I mean, it's exactly the opposite of what we've always been told. Well, we'll be back with that answer and more from you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're going to be back in a moment with more of your calls. You can join us at 800-537-5252. Connect with us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, why should you buy the lettuce in the front of the cooler case rather than the one from the very back? Well, the answer is because that first bag in the display probably has more nutrients. Why? Well, because it's been exposed to light longer than the ones behind it. The New York Times reported this unexpected finding. Now, it turns out Gene L. Lester, he's a plant physiologist with the Department of Agriculture. Now, he says that the amount of nutrients in a leafy food depends on photosynthesis, which is how the plant processes light and keeps itself alive. But you'd think that that would only be sunlight. Well, Lester ran a test on supermarket spinach, keeping it in its plastic storage package at 39 degrees under fluorescent light for 9 days. Other spinach was kept the same way, except in the dark. Well, the fluorescent-lit spinach had more of every nutrient except some of the vitamin A family. Next thought? How to have a light bulb in my refrigerator's crisper bin. Okay, back to your calls and your questions. Call us, 800-537-5252. Shoot us an email, splendidtable.org. We have Greg from New York City patiently waiting. Hi, Greg. What's up?
Hi, how are you?
I am very good. How are you, sir?
Oh, I'm great. I have to tell you that I'm a first-time listener, and I just happened on your program on the way home from Connecticut, and I said, gee, this is some question I could ask Splendid Table and Lynn, and perhaps she could help me.
Well, I'll give it a shot. What's the question?
Okay.
We make no claims at knowing everything.
Well, neither do I. But in any event, I had a Hungarian grandmother and a grandfather. And when I was young, she used to make this most marvelous pastry. And to describe it, it almost had a cookie sort of exterior,
yeah.
And it was in a triangle with a filling. Now, probably the only thing I recall about it was that she used sour cream in it. So, unfortunately, you know, she was the sort of cook that, well, you put this much in, unless it's not enough, then you put more. But in any event, I'm wondering, is there any way you could possibly reconstruct my Hungarian grandmother's pastry so I could try and make it and test that on.
Were they triangular in shape, and were they folded over a filling?
Yeah. Now, I've seen and experienced ones like that. They're called Hamantaschen.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And they come out of Eastern European tradition.
Eastern European tradition, and they're Jewish pastry that's usually served at Purim.
Right.
And it was sort of like that, but I've not had the taste nor the texture in any Hamantaschen that I have ever tried. And of course,
were your grandmother's more lighter and flakier kind of thing?
No, they were very cookie-like, sweetened,
uh-huh.
And very filling, very fulfilling, as I might add.
All right, there's a book done by an author named Rick Rogers on the coffee houses of Vienna. And you may find in that book something close to what you had from your grandmother.
Okay.
And anything that you come across that George Lang's name is attached to.
Mm-hmm.
He's a brilliant restaurateur, and also he did an incredible book. He's Hungarian, mm-hmm. on Hungarian food. It was done many, many years ago. But what I'm thinking is the basic idea behind what your grandmother did was probably a dough that was sour cream and butter and sugar and eggs and flour. Now, that now opens up. It could be a pancake. It could be anything. But this is the way I would do it. I would take a mixer,
mm-hmm.
and I would take sugar and butter. Make sure the butter is at room temperature, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I would do a beat that at medium speed until it's very, very light and fluffy. And then gradually I would beat in an equal amount to the butter of sour cream. So if you have one stick of butter, which is a half a cup of butter, and let's say you have, for argument's sake, a cup of sugar. And again, you'll look at some pastry recipes online to just get a basic balance. You would have then a half a cup of sour cream that you would beat in.
All right, so it's equaling the amount of butter.
Right. And the other thing I would have then is an egg or two that you would beat in one at a time. You're keeping this very fluffy and very light. And then what you're doing is you start to add cake flour that you've sifted, all right? And you may add a half a cup of cake flour and a little bit of milk. and then another half a cup of cake flour and a little bit of milk or more sour cream. And when you get this to, and you want to do this over me, this now is lower speed. You don't want to overwork it because you'll get it tough. Okay? And you'll then wrap it, put it in the refrigerator overnight, and the next day you'll take it out of the fridge and you'll roll it out to the thickness that you remember that pastry being. You'll cut it with a round. It can even be a glass. You'll put the filling in, which could be jam. I don't know what she used, but...
Oh, apricot, generally. Sometimes she took poppy seeds, boiled it in milk and sugar, added those.
It's called mohn, M-O-H-N, at least in some parts of the world, yes. And you can now buy that. It's a poppy seed filling. It's done with honey or sugar, and they're cooked and ground, and it's a great tradition. It's used in a lot of ways in Eastern Europe. The point being, you put the filling in the center of that round cookie and then you fold it over so you make it into a triangle. You just flip over the top and then bake it. And I think you're going to come very close because the idea is it's equal parts of the butter and the sour cream, and adding some lemon zest and a little squirt of lemon will help bring out the tang of the sour cream.
Wonderful.
It's not exact, but it's close.
Well, it's more exact than I have, that's for sure.
And you'll have you can't make anything bad out of that mixture.
I don't think there's a word in Hungarian for cholesterol.
I think you're probably right, but gosh, the food is wonderful.
Yes, it is.
Greg, I wish you good luck with this.
Thank you so much, and continued luck with your wonderful program.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. I have to tell you, you know, this is one of the cuisines people just ignore entirely, but Hungarian food can be so glorious. This was one of the great centers of culture for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. And the crossover of all the different influences on that cuisine are just amazing. Dig in, guys, if you want to try something a little different, really wonderful. Call us, 800-537-5252. We have Brian calling from New Orleans. Brian, hi. What's up? What do you want to talk about?
I'm actually calling from Bossier, which is in North Louisiana. So
I am sorry, sir. The geography sometimes gets very blurry.
All right.
But what can I do for you?
Lovely to talk to you, and you really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I'll tell you what, recently I was doing a dealia, as we say in my part of the world. I'm from Ireland, as you might have gathered.
I would never have guessed that in a million years.
And Delia Smith is a household name where we come from.
Right.
Her cookery books are phenomenally successful, and she's her own BBC series. And doing a delia, basically, recently, I was doing soup à l'oignon gratiné, which, you know, basically your French onion soup.
Right.
And this has never happened to me before with her cookery books, but I couldn't get the onions to caramelize. They just sat there in the pot looking tired and emotional and insipid, and they just would not brown for me. And I'm an elementary school teacher, you know, so I wagged my finger at them menacingly.
And nothing happened.
And still nothing
You can
happened.
Wag that finger forever and nothing happens.
So I didn't know what to do. I was afraid. I thought of possibly that after about 40 minutes on low heat, I thought maybe I might actually give them a bit of welly in terms of heat, you know, crank up the volume.
Yeah, right.
But I didn't have the courage, I suppose, really to go at it with extra heat. I don't know if that would have worked. What do you think?
Well, Brian, let me ask you this. First of all, does she have you doing this in the bottom of the soup pot?
Yeah, you just toss in your onions with a bit of oil and butter, sprinkle a little bit of sugar.
And you cook them slowly until they're browned and as sweet as sugar. Right?
Yeah.
That's the idea. Okay, this is what I would do, all right? This is where you start and you do those onions in a big, wide sauté pan.
All right.
Because what you're doing when you have a lot of onions in a pan that's deep is you're stewing them. Because they throw off so much moisture.
They did, yeah.
Yeah, now if you take the fat that's called for, right? And you put that into your sauté pan, and then you put your onions in. Now they've got a much broader space, a lot more air, and they have very low sides, so all the moisture can evaporate.
All right, so don't cover it then.
Don't cover. No, no, don't. Now, what you can, this is what you can do. You start them at medium high. As soon as you get the oil and the butter fairly hot, you don't want to burn the butter, throw in the onions, stir them around, add the sugar. I always add a bit of salt at that point because it helps draw out the moisture and it flavors them. And then what you do is you turn the heat quite low and you can cover them for about 15, maybe even 20 minutes. And they'll stew. Then you take the cover off and you keep cooking and you stir a bit. And what you want to do is use one of those flat wooden spatulas so you can just scrape it along the bottom of the sauté pan and you keep bringing up that luscious brown glaze that's going to form on the bottom of the pan. Don't use a nonstick pan. Okay?
Really, yeah.
No, you really want to get that glaze because that's the browning and the caramelization. And you can play with the heat, but you want the onions now to start to brown. So you'll get all the sweetness from cooking them covered and stewing them, and then you will start the browning process. And it'll take 40 minutes or so. But that's how, and then you scrape them into the pot and you go on with the recipe.
Listen, that's great. I wanted to ask you as well, if you don't mind, something in confidence there now. I hope nobody's listening. But I was thinking of using a stock cube to make this soup.
No.
No. Well, no, the reason being, of course, that I don't have time to be roasting bones in the oven.
Well, you know, you could cheat a little. You could cheat a little.
I was wondering, have you got a cheater's stock?
You know, funny you should mention this because we do. It's actually, we call it cheater's broth. And essentially what it is that you are browning in the oven onion, slices of onion that you've tossed with olive oil. And if I remember, there's garlic, and I think there's maybe some celery and carrot, if I remember it correctly. It might actually be up on our website, splendidtable.org. And then you put in several cans of chicken broth, and you simmer it for about 20 minutes ahead. Oh, I'm sorry. White wine also goes into it.
White wine, yeah.
But the idea is you're browning just on a piece of foil or whatever. The onion and some of the seasonings, so you get that real caramelization and flavor.
Oh, lovely, yeah.
Yeah, and it's a good broth. It's really, if I do say so myself, it's really a good stand-in.
Oh, excellent.
Okay?
Lovely talking to you.
Hey, good talking to you, too. You take care and enjoy the onion soup.
All right, ciao for now. Bye-bye.
Bye. Now, remember, you can reach us 800-537-5252 or send us an email, splendidtable.org. You know, from the outside looking in, the L.A. food scene shifts every nanosecond. I can only imagine what it looks like to a former resident. Radio producer and food lover Angela Kim left her California home 3 years ago to work here in St. Paul. In fact, right down the hall from me. Well, now she's back in L.A., and I've got her on the phone. Hey, Angela, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I am great. Hey, you were away from Los Angeles for what, 3 years?
Yes, 3 years. Three long, cold years.
Yeah, because I know part of them were spent here in Minnesota. What do you see going back? What are the changes you're seeing?
You know, I didn't appreciate the food in California, I think, when I was here. You never know what's missing until it's gone.
Yeah.
But now, since I'm back in Los Angeles living here, I can try all these great places. And like in Koreatown, for example, it has gotten so big. I just never realized how many selections there are in terms of places. You can go to a restaurant that specializes in just one soup, for example, or you can just go for specific types of barbecue. And I also in Los Angeles, downtown area has revitalized so much. They just opened up a pastrami place that was, I think it was around in the 20s.
Uh-huh.
And they just recently opened it up and renovated the whole thing. It's called Cole's. And it is so beautiful and tasty inside.
Do they make their own pastrami?
You know, actually, I don't know, because when I was there, they actually sold out.
Oh, you mean you couldn't get the pastrami?
No, I went there specific for the pastrami. I went there, it was around 11 o'clock in the evening, because they open late, because they have a bar.
Right.
And I was like, I want the pastrami sandwich. That is what I'm going to get. I know it. And as soon as I asked for it, the waitress said, oh, we've been sold out for a couple hours. We're sorry.
Well, I gather it must be good if everybody's buying it, right?
So. Oh, yeah. And the secret is they have a little bar in the back that's tucked away, almost like a speakeasy. You have to walk all the way in around the back and walk in the doors. It's this dark room. And they have amazing cocktails in there.
Is there sort of one restaurant that's standing out for you, or one kind of, you know, eating that's standing out for you that's new for you?
Oh, God, this is so hard. The one place that I think really encompasses everything that I missed when I was away is this place called Honey Pig. It's a Korean barbecue place in Koreatown. But the thing is, the way you're seated on a round table, so you're there with a bunch of friends sitting around a table, and there's a grill in the middle. But it's not your typical grill that's flat. It's actually like a dome, and you put the meat on top. We got the pork belly, and you put the meat on top, and then on the next circular layer, you kind of put the vegetables and all the fixings around it. So the juices from the pork belly just drizzle down. It gets absorbed.
Oh, boy. So is this like an upside-down wok that's hot in the middle of the table?
Exactly. And the topper is at the end of your meal. You think you're done because everything is off the grill. You've eaten everything up. It's gone. But they come out with rice, and they make like a kimchi. It's like a spicy kimchi-fried rice. So all the juices that are still there, they're used up. They don't go to waste. And the smells, I can't even explain how sweet and savory the smell is. And the best thing is you experience it with people. Like for me, eating has been about communicating and catching up with friends and being introduced to new things and also having friends experience it with me. And that's been the best part about it.
This is a communal meal. This is a I can just see this.
It's a family style done in a whole new different way.
All right. We're going to do this. Hey, Angela, thank you.
Anytime.
Angela Kim is a producer on the Marketplace Sustainability Desk and blogs about food, so check it out. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number's 800-537-5252. You have a great week, and let me leave you with this little pun. What vegetable did Noah not take on the ark with him? Leeks. The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media. Now, you're going to find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. And also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with Shubha Bala and Judy Boudreau. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The website is managed by Sarah Lear. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. But we'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
American Public Media. I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.